This is the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Fur Neiman. If you're looking to generate wealth and passive income in the lucrative world of mobile home parks, you're in the right place. You'll discover solutions to the common legal and operational pitfalls and how to optimize parks to maximize income. Your host is in the trenches. He's a real estate attorney, financial analyst, and mobile home park investor and operator. Now, let's turn it over to Fur Neiman.
Welcome back, Mobile Home Park Nation. Fur Neiman here again today with another episode of the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast. Got another great guest for you. I just heard this guy speak a couple weeks ago at CECO conference down in Atlanta. He gives some really good presentations. Really excited to have him. He's with Saddleback Valley Communities. Please help me welcome my guest, Ben Brabham. Ben, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, no problem. Good to be here. Thanks, sir.
Yeah, well, I was really blown away with your one presentation. I didn't get to see all of the second one because of an appointment, but you were a fan favorite at the Atlanta conference. Like, I got to get this guy on here, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot of invitations to speak based on that presentation. But before we jump too much into specifics, I mean, tell us your background. You've been in this game longer than most of us, so it's interesting that you've been able to see some cycles. I'll be interested to hear your view on where we're at today as well, but maybe tell us your background, how you get into MH.
Yeah, sure. So I did get started in the early 2000s. So it's been about 20 years. And I actually got started because I was kind of been a serial entrepreneur. I was in the military and then I was in law enforcement. But all along, even in my teens and early 20s, I always was really passionate about real estate and was doing some spec home building, single family, and ended up having a neighbor put up three manufactured homes in the time it took us to build one. And so, you know, once I figured out what he was doing, I got a dealer's license and started buying, multi-section homes and doing pit sets. So it did that for a number of years, sold probably 40, 50 houses, and ultimately then got into multifamily. So some apartment buildings and ultimately my first mobile home park, which was in 2005. So, and from then until now, it's been a pretty windy path, but, had created a, we're small by comparison to many, but we've had 40, 50 parks at once that we manage, which is about where we're at today. And so kind of, made all kinds of mistakes and learned all kinds of lessons along the way in terms of operating. And to your point in question, it's been a really interesting through the GFC and even through the most recent cycles with sort of the capital markets changing. And so yeah, learned a ton and love the business and love to talk shop and share where I can. I had a lot of help along the way when I was getting going. So happy to share anything that's helpful.
Yeah, appreciate it. So obviously you've bought a number of parks. You've got a lot of lessons learned. What are some key things that you've, mistakes maybe, or just challenges you faced earlier that, you don't make the same mistake today or you do differently? And I'm also curious, what deals do you buy differently? Obviously, you're going to have more financial capacity than you did on deal one, but irrespective of that, how does your deal criteria change over the years?
Yeah, well, so the first thing I would say is when we first getting started, we didn't have anything known as acquisition criteria. We were opportunistic. I mean, we looked everywhere under every rock, and if it looked like it was a mobile home park that was halfway successful, we were all over it. And so today we have much more defined and much narrower acquisition criteria. A lot of that is because the bumps and bruises we've taken along the way. But so really today we have a much more refined and detailed acquisition criteria. Some things that I think that we've changed is I've seen a lot of people use what I would call a shotgun approach, kind of like us in the early days, fly to Ohio from California or some place far flung. And, buy something because it was compelling from a cap rate perspective. And for us, big change in terms of our criteria is we much prefer to buy portfolios. And if we can't buy a portfolio, we try to buy a large enough property where we can sort of plant a flag and then build around it. So our strategy these days is largely around concentration. And it's because of the way we operate. We have to have enough scale to be able to afford the on-site resources that we need to be successful. So that's a huge change. It was kind of always in the background, but now it's very intentional and very forefront in terms of, what we look to buy. It's hard because I see deals today that are really compelling, kind of one-off 75 space park or something. And 15 years ago, I'd have been on a plane. And today, I have to pass. And it's just, there's nothing wrong with the asset or even the market in most cases. It's just not part of our geographic focus. So that's a big change for us.
Yeah, that's a similar strategy I see for a lot of groups that are getting, as they get larger or they enter the space and want to jump in large to begin with, is just that concentration, whether it's hubs or large parks. So how has that changed your pricing expectations and or your deal sourcing? Because what I see a lot of is, you know, the 250 space park, I'd like to buy it too, but it's super competitive and it is priced very aggressively by a national broker, as opposed to me building rapport with mom and pa. And I know you also told stories of, you know, even buying from some of the biggest players in the industry, which I think is a rare feat to accomplish. So maybe give you some feedback on deal buying and sourcing.
Yeah. So for sourcing, you know, you're right. There's a premium, kind of a portfolio premium that you have to somewhat expect. And so we've tried to create a lane where we historically, going back to 2008 and '09, bought deals that had hair on them, deals that bigger shops that would be more competitive in those larger scale acquisitions declined for whatever reason. So, you know, put that in context, we bought, you know, 750 spaces that were 52% occupied. And of those 52, so, you know, you're talking 350 plus vacant homes or vacant lots. And in addition, there was 120 or 130 homes that came with the deal. 20 of those were vacant. One of the parks had a wastewater treatment plant. One of them had master meter gas. So, you know, if you're going to have that sort of criteria, to your point, you know, you're going to be competing with the REITs and the biggest shops out there. And so, you know, I'm not advising somebody to go take on deals that have a lot of hair on them. But for us, it was a timing thing. We happened to be able to move, you know, at a point in time where most of these other shops had kind of been dislocated or sort of frozen. At the time, it was around GFC. But there's other examples I could share, you know, all the way up until a month ago, where really what we try to do is pick our moment in time and then have unique strategies around stuff that other people might not be able to get comfortable with. So we get really deep in these assets, in these markets. And if we can, you know, we attempt to mitigate the risk and or get comfortable. And that's what allows us to basically acquire deals that otherwise we'd have been priced out of. And the other thing I'd say is we're not a shop that's, you know, has to deploy equity. We're incredibly opportunistic. And what that means typically is we'll buy a deal every couple of years. And it typically it's a larger deal, but our history is, you know, 2 to 3 years in between acquisitions. And that's because what we buy takes a fair amount of time to digest and process. And it's a cautionary tale around bandwidth. A few years ago, I bought over 30 parks in 3 years, which was rare in my career and history, but there was an opportunity to do that. And we took the opportunity, but it was a reminder for me, you know, when you're taking on distressed or high value add type projects that, you know, you really can kind of get buried under your own weight. And so for us, you know, again, historically, it's about selection of assets that provide scale, but doing that at a pace that's logical and in moments of time where you have market dislocation or kind of unique opportunity. And that's how I've built my portfolio.
I think that's really strategic. And that's great because I recently heard, you know, that we all have heard, what are the three rules for real estate? You know, location, location, location. I recently heard somebody say, no, it's timing, timing, timing. And it sounds like that's been part of your approach as well. And I think back in my career, and I haven't hit them all perfect, right? There's a deal that I wish I would have bought. I coulda, shoulda, woulda. The timing wasn't right. I didn't have the money lined up. I didn't have the management personnel lined up. Wish I would have got it done. There's other deals I'm like, I hit it just somewhat dumb luck. Somewhat, I saw the opportunity. I jumped on it and it hit a home run when I almost passed on it. And then, you know, there's ebbs and flows of that. But that's interesting that you say that, because a lot of guys, the goal is buy. And it's yours is, I'm going to buy something strategic because it's got hair on it. It's going to take time to digest, but because it's got hair on it, it's going to be more price attractive because it doesn't have the same level of competition. So it's a, you know, not a shotgun approach, more of a rifle approach of, you know, zero in and tackle one at a time.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's some big signals that they're pretty obvious in terms of macro trends. When you think about, you know, we bought about 1500 lots from 2008, nine through like 2011. And that was a period where, you know, especially in 2008, nine, even 2010, capital markets were largely frozen. There wasn't a lot of, it was kind of peak uncertainty, kind of similar to today. Back then it was more of peak uncertainty or discomfort in the market, but you're seeing tinges of that show up over the last 12 months or 8 months for sure. And for me, the theme is really around available capital and what type of debt's available and at what cost. So for us, you know, we kind of try to follow those signals, kind of block out the noise. And those are the moments where we try to be very focused on acquisitions. Sometimes when you're sort of swimming upstream, when you've got tons of competition and deals are priced at 2 and 3 caps, it's really hard to structure anything without being completely dependent on something external, like massive lot rent increases or something that's for us not as predictable or certainly not as controllable internally. So we're focused on things where we can create and drive value with internal controllable variables, not something external like market appreciation. But the flip side of that too is when you have those macro tailwinds, you know, you want to ride that wave too. But for us, it's trying to align both of those. And that's when we get really focused and, you know, try to be prepared to kind of get in when the getting's good type thing. And when it's not, don't try to force it, to still buy deals when they make sense. But that's why we don't have a bunch of funds raised that we have pressure to deploy. It's really just, does it fit our criteria? Does it meet our needs? And do we have the bandwidth and the team to execute? Particularly if the risk in the deal is execution risk. We have to manage our own big eyes or big stomach as it relates to, like you said, having to pass on deals that we would love. We're just not positioned to do that. And it's too much risk to push it. So we don't.
No, again, I think that's a thoughtful approach for sure. You mentioned, you know, 08, 09, a lot of us were not in the business or even any business perhaps at that time. You mentioned some parallels to today. What do you see as the key differences from then and today? And how are you, you know, specifically attacking new acquisitions right now? Or just, you know, different underwriting, obviously, from a financial assumption on the debt terms. Has it impacted your ability to raise money? I hear of a lot of syndicators that are struggling to raise money because they're not competing against apartments anymore. They're competing against treasuries. Yeah. I haven't had that experience lately. My most recent two acquisitions, I already had the money subscribed and ready. So I haven't had to go back out in the market in the last, you know, 120 days, but I will soon. And I'm just curious what your view has been on that.
Well, for us, you know, we're unique in that we don't really raise outside capital. We kind of recycle equity. I've got basically three LPs that I've had for 25 years, mostly. So I'm fortunate in that way. But that's also part of the story around how and why we have gaps. So we have to create value, recycle and or extract our equity and to be able to move forward. So it's not entirely accurate. I have a partner that I've worked with for the last 4 or 5 years that's kind of new to me. And, you know, that did pour fuel on the fire. But generally speaking, like I haven't raised outside equity, so I'm not the guy who can speak to that per se. But I have seen the other side of it. I've seen a lot of shops raise hundreds of millions of dollars and then have tons of pressure to deploy that. So I can't really address that. It's not part of my background. But to your other questions in terms of 08, 09, and then the parallels to today or what's different, the difference to me primarily is rate of change. So when you looked at 2008 and, you know, Lehman falling out in September and everything that happened there, you had an overnight change from, you know, capital was freely flowing to just the emergency brake was hit. I mean, one anecdotal example is we had term sheets back at that moment from a lender who, before we ordered third parties, they were no longer in business. And in fact, that happened twice during that time frame. Wow. So we haven't seen that sort of thing yet, but where I see parallels is you're starting to see lender pullback due in part, especially with the regional banks, to their own reserve requirements and their own pressure. You mentioned, you know, treasuries, and it's really hard when they're having to borrow money and their deposits are kind of fleeing sort of at the same time. The natural effect for them is that they're less aggressive. They're having to pull back, and it's challenging for them because their profits are declining at the same time. They have less of a spread So for them, but the reality for us as investors and borrowers is that, you know, what used to be a 75% LTC deal is probably now a 60%, maybe even lower. What used to be a 1-2 debt service coverage ratio might now be a 1-3. And the whole point of it is that it's more challenging to borrow money, and it's higher cost, obviously, for now. And so for us, the question you asked is, what are we doing different? You know, a lot of the last three or four deals that I've closed, which are over the last 14 months, they all had a seller finance component. We did have bank debt, but, you know, we may have borrowed 60 to 70% from a lender in first position. And then we had a seller come in behind them, you know, with another 10 or 20% to kind of get our capital stack back up to, call it 80% type leverage. So that's what's different. That's what's similar back then. That's the sort of thing that got deals closed as well. It was creative financing, a lot of times seller participation. But the difference from then to now is we haven't as of yet seen any kind of significant fallout, or at least in terms of measuring by rate of change, in terms of how quickly it changed from day to night. We haven't seen that yet, but I'm seeing a repetitive theme that I hope doesn't show up in the same extreme way, but it's starting to show up in terms of just a lack of available credit. And that's affecting deals. It's affecting, you're seeing more deals linger. They're not trading as quickly. There's price reductions. You know, that's leading to more availability or deal flow because they're just not going on and going off the market as quickly. So that's a good thing. I think the challenge is how do you take it down? And that's where you have to potentially do something different than you did 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, good points. I spoke to a couple brokers recently at conferences, and I asked them, I said, how's business? And they said, you know, the guys that are usually the life of the party just have their head down. Like, it's a rough year, you know? And I'm like, are deals not going under contract, or are they going under contract and just not closing? And they said combination. And they said a lot of the closings, similar to what you said, there's a retrade on price, or there's a retrade on terms and there's a seller carry. Yeah. And I'm under LOI on a deal right now, and it's $2.25 million. And I talked to the lender, and I talked back to the seller the other day, and I said, I can still pay your price, but I'm going to need you to seller carry $500K. And I said, my goal would be to, you know, get you out of there in 2 years and put this loan on agency if rates come back down. He goes, so you need it for 2 years? I said, no, I need it for five. Because the land loan with the regional bank is going to be 5 year. They're not going to let your balloon pop before theirs. So I'll tell you, in good faith, I'm going to try to get you out in two, but contractually I need five. And that means you're not going to get your 500K. And then, you know, and I disclose the level of different risk and all that. I mean, you can't use it to go buy a boat, and you can't use the 1031 effectively, and so on. So I haven't got the response from him, but that's kind of where I'm at. So I mean, I'm curious on your view. So in this example, you know, 2.25 million, if it was 2 years ago, I could easily pay that price and I get a 75-80% loan. But now if I'm going to get a 60% loan, I feel like I either need to get the price down, which he doesn't want to do, or I need to change my capital stack and say, I'm going to get 60 from the bank and 20 from you. And I'm going to put 20 in. Do you have in those examples, would you have a preference of, you know, get a little bit of a discount and just have low leverage, or pay more price but have higher leverage through seller finance? I mean, I realize you can run the iterations in the financial modeling, but just in general, what would your tactic be on, you know, crossing that chasm?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the truth is, you know, I'd have to know more about the equity and what the expectations are, what the hurdles. If you've got prefs you have to cover, or if you've got, you know, a deal where you've got tight coverage, I'd probably rather have more insulation around some kind of massive failure, meaning paying a little bit higher price and having a structure that gives me the room to execute on my pro forma. But, you know, all things equal, I'd rather have a lower price. But in many cases, to your point and question and example, I'd probably pay more and get the type of financing and debt that I need. At the end of the day, though, what it does for me is it really causes me to go back to my underwrite and ensure that in this climate, this is a deal I want to buy at that, you know. And I'm not a guy who retrades. I don't put deals under contract and just, you know, try to line up the stuff. If I go under contract, I'm going to close unless something significant changes. So, you know, for me, if I latched onto that deal at 225, I probably like it. I probably want to close it. And the truth is, I'd close it in either case. I'd close it with a discount if I could, you know, backfill that downstroke, or I'd, you know, take a seller carry to get the leverage that I needed, so long as the cash flow all worked out. And the thing for me is that it'd have to be enough value creation potential, something, whether it's revenue creation, whether it's expense reduction or utility pass-throughs, if there was enough there for me to, you know, gone under contract in the first place, one of those two scenarios or solutions would probably get the deal done for me, a smaller discount or a larger seller carry. But the thing that I'm finding now, and brokers are kind of living this day to day, is that the transactional volume has just screeched to a halt. And in part, it's these sellers who are facing these same questions from legitimate buyers like you, that do I want to carry? Do I want to discount? Do I want to hold it? And the discount thing's tough, because while we all have seen cap rates elevate, the comps, that we haven't seen a lot of closed comps at lower valuations. So from a broker who's taken a listing, trying to defend the price reduction, you know, it takes a seller who says, you know what, I want to unown this thing today. And, you know, I might've already missed peak, but I don't want it to decline any further. And I don't want to own this through this next cycle. But not everybody's there. I think some people are still on the fence. Some people are holding out for their number, and or some people think that, you know, in a quarter or two, things are going to turn around and they're just going to wait it out. But the deals that I'm seeing getting done are happening exactly the way you described. You got a buyer who's latched on, they like the deal, a seller who has capitulated and says, this is what the market is today, and I'm going to trade it, under one of those two examples he gave. So, you know, and that's the deals that are closing today. That's exactly what I'm seeing. And the deals that aren't, they're listed, but it's not a real seller. And or the broker is trying to get some of us to write offers to sort of educate the seller on what the market is, because it has changed, fairly quickly for some of these folks who don't pay as much attention to the market, these sellers.
Yeah, so. On that last point, I have had some brokers say, hey, can you make me a lowball offer on this so my seller gets sober? I'm like, I don't want to be in the middle of that. No. But they're like, yeah, the price is here. I'm like, we both know it's not worth that. He goes, everybody knows it's not worth that except my client. And I was like, exactly. Bring it in a lower offer. You brought up another good variable on my hypothetical, as to, you know, which of the two options you could pursue. And that variable is, what's your cost of capital, including your cost of equity? Because, yeah, on this particular deal, it's like, if I, you know, the deal, if the assets work 2.25, that's great. But if based on a 60% loan, I can't meet my pref and my hurdles, the expectations of my LPs are such that I can't do the deal. I don't want to set myself up for failure with them, especially because I get paid after the hurdle. I don't want to do it for practice. So in the current lending environment, I can't make 2.25 work for me, for my investors, even though it's a fair price. It's a fair price. I told the seller this. I said, if you want yesterday's price, I need yesterday's rates. Yeah. And I'm not smooth enough talker to convince the bank to give me a 3.75% loan. So you got to lower your price, or you got to be banker. And I don't, you don't have to be the whole banker, but you got to be 20% of the banker, and don't get greedy. I had another deal with seller carry, and the guy's like, okay, I'll seller carry. I want 7%. I want points. I'm like, you're pushing too hard, man. You know, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. Let's, you know, do we want to transact or not? You know, and I think he'll come around, and it'll be a win-win, but I can't just, I told him, I'm not just bluffing. I can't just stretch. And I said, do the math. You know what your NOI is better than me. Go get a loan at this price with that NOI.
Exactly. And then trying to push you to all the upside. Here's what you can do month one or month two. Like those days kind of are gone in terms of the euphoria, and the market's kind of dissipated. And I think you're seeing that. And that's why the transactional volume has slowed, because guys who are reaching and saying, well, you know, when I get to end of year one, everything looks fine. The numbers look good. I can meet my prefs and all my hurdles. But no, it's sentiment right now. There's just uncertainty, and nobody that I know is pushing through that sort of stuff the way that they used to. And to me, that's healthy, that they probably shouldn't. And those who are, probably, you know, they could pay the price. I mean, and so I think it's wise to, that's why I said, you know, I would go back and look at my underwrite and make sure, yep, this is still a deal that I want under the terms and the way that I'm having to structure the deal. So, and I've been in the same boat. I've lost a couple of deals that I was really disappointed to have not been able to close. But you know, you've got to be disciplined. I mean, I mentioned it, one of my things in Atlanta that, you know, we lost a great one this year in Sam Zell. And one of his famous quotes that I love is, we suffer because we know the numbers. Yeah. And so, you know, if you go back to that in every instance, the numbers to me provide the path, you know, close the deal because it makes sense, or pass and maybe comes back around when the seller decides, you know, he actually does want to trade it. And worst case, you don't get them all, but that's okay too. I'm not the guy who thinks, you know, that there's just this finite few left and there's not enough to go around. Like, there's always deals to be had, and I'm fortunate I've got all that I need, but I still want to buy more if it makes sense. But if it doesn't, you know, I'm okay with letting them go. And somebody else gets it, you know, good for them, and all the best with it. Congrats, you know. But that, I think you have to have that attitude, particularly in these sorts of cycles or this time that we're in at the moment.
Yeah, I recently lost out on a deal, and it's kind of first. Yeah, it's like, that's a bummer, but I'm like, I know what I underwrote.
Right.
I'm getting probably similar debt and probably similar equity. So the difference was rapidity of infill. And if this guy can do, if I can do 12 a year and he thinks he can do 30, good, more power to him, because I can't do 30. Right. And we'll see if he can. But, you know, I wasn't going to underwrite 30. I could have paid a lot more if I did. But I'm, you know, that's a lot of info. So I'm not going to go that route. Just kind of my thing. Another question, series of questions for you, Ben. You've obviously gone from, you know, small, medium, now a large operator. What are some strategies or words of wisdom for the medium? We have a lot of people who have been on here who have gone from small to kind of medium to medium. You have gone, you know, and I don't know what the definition is. I feel like medium is 5 to 12 parks. And once you get up over, and obviously, you know, as a 10 unit park or 200 unit park, they're all, you know, that's a different variable. But when you start talking 20 parks, 25, 30, obviously there's a team behind you. What advice would you give somebody who's at the 5 to 10 parks trying to get to 30 or 40? You know, I mean, let's say they're 50 site parks. So, you know, 500 sites or so up to 2,500 sites, big jump. How do you get there? And is it worth it?
You know, a couple of thoughts. And first, I'd say, you know, for everybody, and I remind myself of this all the time, you know, run your own race. And by that, I mean, you know, it's easy to see everybody else. So-and-so's closed another 10, you know, 10,000 sites or 1,000 sites or 5 more parks. And we get caught up in that mentally sometimes. And I think the first reminder is, you know, run your own race, go at a pace that makes sense. But a couple other thoughts, you know, we've grown to our size because we really leaned into technology. We have a lot of automations. We have a relatively small team in relation to the size of the business. And I think that makes a ton of sense in terms of keeping operating costs down. Like, I try to hold myself accountable around a roughly 40% OPEX ratio. And, you know, that's difficult when you buy a 50% occupied deal. But in terms of back office and team, you know, it's really important to right size relative to your revenue. And we were able to do that largely through primarily technology and automations. But the other thing is, I, as a cautionary tale, I definitely stayed too small as a team, and we kind of outgrew, and then everybody was wearing multiple hats. And that's when we started to fail, you know, ourselves in terms of the quality of our operations and the rigor and the diligence. So it's a real balancing act between, you know, I've seen some groups come in and try to build for the future, which makes sense, but they're forwarding in some cases millions of dollars in payroll when they don't have a business that's, you know, delivering revenue to support that. So that again puts pressure, just like if you raised a bunch of money, now you've got this massive overhead and you've got to go buy virtually anything to just justify your team. So it's this push and pull between being right-sized and being able to do a good job and being able to and staying efficient and lean, so that you're profitable and you're positioned to take advantage. So for us, you know, two things, you know, the technology thing was huge and the automations. If I had it to do over again, I would have grown the team a little bit earlier than I did. But if I had only those two options, I'd probably do it the way that I did, mostly in my case, because of cash flow. But the other thing too, is, you know, the way you grow, again, the shotgun approach is really difficult to manage when it's disparate sites across, you know, 20 different states. I think the concentration thing really helps in terms of scaling. It's easy for us if we've got 900 lots in one market, that's one team. We usually manage that one team with one on-site leader. And it allows for a kind of a consolidated rolled up organizational chart where, you know, I might have 9 different states, but I deal with, you know, maybe 4 or 5 people on a daily basis. And I think the alternative is you have, you know, smaller parks scattered over, you know, half the country, and you have one person who's underpaid really relative to what they're doing. And those folks, you know, you get what you pay for. So in some cases they're phenomenal. They do a great job, but if you're really trying to scale intentionally, I think, again, I go back to that concentration comment and pace. And to your point about small, medium, large ish, all of those things really distill down in, and you have to synthesize all that into that strategy. I think, you know, in the past, you buy what's available because it made sense. And I see people do that all the time. But that's where scaling the business can get really challenging when you have, you know, 15 different managers, each managing 50 to 80 sites independently in a fragmented nature. It just really breaks down. Your costs go up because you've got to fly out to all these different locations. So again, I kind of lean back on that comment around strategically scaling, usually using some kind of concentrated geographic focus. And then the other things I mentioned, technology and pace. So
as far as technology and automation, any specifics you can share? I mean, if it's proprietary, then of course we can respect it. And if there's anything, you know, do you use a monday.com or a rent manager or some other, you know, Google Sheets or, you know, anything, you know, or something super sophisticated beyond all of those, or what specifically can you share?
Most of our stuff is off the shelf, truly. So we've used Rent Manager for a long time, and you know, there's different ways to use Rent Manager. Some people, you know, say they use Rent Manager, and in my view, they use like 1/100th of the capability. And so for us, it's really just building out a database and the automations that are already baked into that platform and or plugins to their fullest extent. So like a couple of examples. All of our leases, and none of this stuff is earth shattering. I mean, most operators do this today, but as an example, delinquency or collection efforts, you know, we've been able to automate that. So, you know, folks get their invoice obviously emailed to them, but then they get a reminder text on, you know, say the 4th or 5th. Then on the 8th, they might get a text and or email. On the 15th, they get a phone call. In the past, that was all very high touch manual stuff by our team. People would, you know, we used to hang things on the door. We used to door knock. We'd call them. We'd text them. All of the above. All that now that I just described happens fully in the background, 100% automated. It's not to say that we don't need to manage that or keep an eye on it or participate on some level, but the amount of hours that were spent on that one task are now for us spent on lease ups and marketing and keeping the parks managed and building community. And so that's just one example. And I could give you 10 or 15 similar examples where the software, the platform already has that available. It didn't cost really any more money. It was just configuring it and using it and reinforcing it. We've tried a lot of things that we thought were happening in our business, but some manager downstream didn't like it. They wanted to do it the old way. And so sometimes when you find something that works, it's the reinforcement and say, no, this is our SOP. This is the way it's done. It's not optional. And, you know, sometimes you have to hold their hand and make sure they understand it and they're not afraid of it. But at the end of the day, consistency around these sorts of operating standards and practices and best practices really is what we have to reinforce. The one-offs and this property manager doesn't like to do it this way. They do it their own way. That gets really challenging as you scale. It's fine if you've got a handful of parks. It's really not the best way to do it, but it works. You can keep your arms around it. But as things get bigger, these are the types of things that both help you grow, but also can be speed bumps or roadblocks if you don't watch those types of, you know, more granular, you know, processes.
Yeah, I've found that when you have, you know, whether it's one or two or several star players, you kind of let them do their own thing, but then it doesn't work as you get bigger. Because they're doing something differently, and then they're training somebody else differently, and the next person doesn't have their skills. And I think about, you know, like a lot of great athletes, very rarely do they make great coaches.
Right.
And part of it's because it came naturally to them and they don't understand why you can't just fall out of bed and hit right. like Ted Williams. Right. Mm-hmm. And part of it's because they don't understand why you don't put in the blood, sweat, and tears that they did. So it's yeah. a truly great coach recognizes the individual pros and cons of each person and then puts together a team and builds a system around the team that the parts fall into. And right. I feel like that's kind of what training managers is like, okay, I can't be like, well, you're good at construction, so you need to do these pieces, but you're good at sales, you do these pieces. And then like, no, you got to have as much as you can as like, you know, centralized, you know, or common tasks and common yeah. responsibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. And your question about should you scale or should you aim? I mean, obviously it's a very personal choice and personal decision, but you have to kind of acknowledge and recognize that if you're choosing to go down that road, the things that used to work really well for me when I had 3 to 5 parks or, you know, I just can't do that anymore. And I find myself sometimes frustrated that I'm boxed in to an organization that, you know, we're not bureaucratic. We're still really lean and pretty flat, but at the end of the day, there's certain non-negotiables because I can't have a one-off anomaly. I can't have one manager kind of fly in their own kite in a different direction. Like everything has to be on the same wavelength or else I can't keep my arms around it. So, you know, for me, I don't think I'll ever be, you know, the big REIT size operator. And it's because I don't want to be. There's certain ways that I like to operate that work for me. And, you know, I've gotten comfortable with this level of scale and will probably, like I said, continue to bolt on or acquire as it makes sense at a pace that works for us. But there's no grand plan of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 spaces. It's real. And part of it, again, is kind of my own personal constraints or comfort around how I want to live my life. And, you know, at this stage, I'm comfortable. And that's how I look at it is, okay, I just bought 3 more parks this year. I'm going to get my foundation under me and kind of see how it goes. And then I'll reassess and say, okay, I'm ready to buy 5 more. Or, you know what, this is it for now until we get X, Y, or Z straightened out, or we have cash flow or, you know, insulation around coverage. We're just out of the market. And that's different probably than a lot of folks that you'd talk to, but I think that's a piece that people overlook in terms of be careful what you wish for. Make sure it's still meeting your lifestyle goals, your personal goals, and not, you know, the business isn't driving you. And it's easy to, personally, I can attest, it's easy to get caught up in bigger, better, more, and it's just so unnecessary.
Yeah, great points, great wisdom there. Well, Ben, this is good. Before we jump, anything in particular you want to share? Any other closing thoughts or tips or tricks or stories, and then also how people can reach out to you and find you as well?
I mean, I don't have a ton, like I said, you know, there's nothing real proprietary. I believe in this business. I love this industry. It's changed my life literally and a lot of other lives that I know. So I'm a huge advocate. I think, you know, sometimes as an industry, we can be our own worst enemy. And I think in terms of things to anticipate and headwinds, I'm telling my whole team, and we're living it in real time, that it's probably going to get more difficult to do the same thing that we've been doing for the last 20 years because of regulation and government intervention. And we've got to power through that. We've got to persevere. We've got to be the good actors in that scenario. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't raise rent if it's appropriate to do it. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying to summarize is that if you're considering getting into this industry, I can't think of a better place to put your time and attention and focus. I think you'll be well rewarded in a number of ways, but it's not easy. It's a simple business in terms of concept, but it's not easy. So jump in, do your homework, be careful, be cautious, but man, it can literally change your life. So, and then in terms of, you know, I don't have anything for sale or anything like that. I'm not raising money. I'm just a regular operator like many of you listening or folks who want to be. So you can find me on LinkedIn. My email is ben@saddlebackpro.com. If I can help you, I will. But anyway, yeah, that's what I've got.
Ben, this is great. Appreciate your time. Appreciate you sharing all your thoughts and wisdom.
Sure. Absolutely. It's fun. Thanks for
take care.
You've been listening to the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Ferd Niemann. Ready to learn more? Go to www.themobilehomelawyer.com for free resources and materials to help you succeed. If you love the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts, give us your review, and subscribe today. Thank you for listening. Neither the Supreme Court of Missouri nor the Missouri Bar reviews nor approves certifying organizations or specialist designations. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.